Farm, subscribe to Rabbi Moishe. He'll answer everything you ask. Only a fool would scroll past our Rabbi Moishe's podcast.
Welcome to the Sukkos class. We are going to be analyzing the spiritual meaning, one of the spiritual themes of Sukkot. A little bit of background. Let me do a little intro. Okay. High holidays. High holidays. Just finished. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. For those of you who are here, it was beautiful. If you weren't here, I'm sure it was beautiful wherever you were. They really are beautiful, awesome days. And I can speak personally that, especially when it comes to Yom Kippur, when I was younger, I didn't really appreciate it. I kind of, like, tolerated it and survived. But the older I get, the more I actually look forward to Yom Kippur, the more I enjoy Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is an amazing, amazing day. And yes, there's a lot of prayers, and yes, you're fasting, but that's all part of it, and it's all combines to give Yom Kippur its power and leave its impression on you, at least for the day. The problem that I found, and I doubt I'm the only one, is that effect fades very quickly. You go through Rosh Hashanah, you go through Yom Kippur, and it could be an intensely beautiful experience. It could be very uplifting. It could be very enlightening. You feel your soul. You feel close to God. You feel your Jewishness. You feel all kinds of very strong Jewish feelings, and they're real. You're not delusional, but it passes. And because they pass almost as quickly as they came, you're left after Yom Kippur, within 24 hours of Yom Kippur, you could feel like Yom Kippur never happened. It's possible. And it's not a crime, it's not a sin, it's sort of the nature of the thing. Yom Kippur lands on you. Yom Kippur is not something that you sort of earn or build up. Yom Kippur, you show up to Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur shows up to you, more accurately. And so inevitably, it's going to dissipate. And the effect or the experience of Yom Kippur is not going to remain the same forever. And there really is the tragedy of the stereotypical three times a year Jew. I'm not saying that to judge them. I'm just saying, it's such an intense experience, by definition. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is so intense, it's asking too much of yourself to expect that to carry you through the year. It's too intense to bridge. You can't live in Rosh Hashanah mode all year long. You can't live in Yom Kippur mode all year long. Imagine every day living like Yom Kippur. It's mind-boggling. It's way too much. It's very overwhelming. And it was never meant to be that way. That was not the point. The point of Yom Kippur is not that you adopt a Yom Kippur posture and a Yom Kippur mindset for the rest of the year. It's once a year. The Torah calls it Achad Bashana. It's this one time a year thing. Very unique. Very rare and very special. Again, it's all part of its power. It's so intense and so awesome that it's Yom Kippur. If we had that every week for Shabbat, it wouldn't be the same. It wouldn't have the same. I don't think you could pull off a Yom Kippur once a week. Even if you tried, it would become routinized. It would become, you know. Rabbi Sachs has a very interesting point. He writes about which Jewish holidays are most commonly popularly observed by Jews of all stripes and right across the board, not just Orthodox, not just religious, like Jews writ large. So which holidays are the most popular, commonly observed across the entire Jewish nation? What would you say?
Yom Kippur.
What else?
Pesach.
What else? Yeah? Purim? You think? Yeah, okay. What else? That's it? Yom Kippur, Hanukkah, Pesach? Are we all... If you rank the holidays in the Jewish calendar from 1 to 10, a scale of very easy to observe or very difficult and challenging to observe, where would you rank Pesach? 1 is easy, 10 is difficult.
9.
You would say 9? Give me a number. 10 is difficult, 1 is easy. You would say 6? She says 9.
I think Pesach is the third hardest holiday.
Give me a number.
7.
Seven?
Yeah.
Eight? Five. Okay. Nobody said less than five. Nobody said it's from the easiest ones. It's all sort of trending up. Right? That's unanimous for sure. Give me a ranking for Yom Kippur. Scale of 1 to 10?
9.
10? 8? How is it that we all had a consensus here of the three most commonly observed holidays? Two of three, you all said basically unanimously, are either really hard or, you know, fairly difficult. There are much easier holidays that are not up there with the commonly popularly observed holidays. What else?
No one observes it.
Tu B'Av, easy holiday. What else? Give me some easy holidays. Tu B'Shvat. Shavuot is an easy holiday. Very good. Somebody said Purim yet?
Purim is fine.
Said Purim. Purim is easy.
A lot of people who observe Pesach, like I think the statistics are 98% of Israelis have a Pesach Seder.
Yeah.
90% Jews in Israel have a Pesach Seder.
Yeah.
But of that percentage, maybe half of them actually don't eat chametz for 7 days.
Fine. But even the Seder is a lot of work. Even the Seder is not easy. Not just a meal.
No.
It's not just a meal.
Just wait till you have to prepare.
It's not just a meal, and they're buying special kosher Pesach food, and they're doing all kinds of things. Pesach dishes, they're cleaning. It's very common.
Don't think about it now.
It's very common.
People are religious, don't have Pesach dishes. They don't have any of that.
You'd be surprised. You're wrong. You're flat out wrong.
They probably use their Pesach dishes.
You're flat out wrong.
Really?
You're flat out wrong. There are people who eat everything in the world all year long, and on Pesach, they keep kosher.
A lot of people don't keep Pesach.
I'm talking about all kinds of people that would surprise you. Jews are full of surprises. Anyway, so it's interesting. We have difficult holidays that are very commonly observed. We have easier holidays that are not commonly observed. How do you explain that? If you would say that, you know, the broader scope of the Jewish people not being religious would want to hold on to some sort of vestige of Judaism, but not be ready for the real buy-in, they should all be doing the easy holidays. So why is it that Yom Kippur is up there? Every Jew I know fasts on Yom Kippur.
More significant.
So his point, his thing is that when a holiday demands more of you, it's like the subliminal message is, this one's really important. And over the generations, even when people are not being so religious and they're like, look, I'm not so religious, I can't do it all. But this one, oh, wait a second. This one, you don't play around with this one. You know, you might not go to shul on Shavuot, but Yom Kippur, hello? So the implication of that is that when something's very difficult, it's also very important. And the implication is that when you're training and educating children and you think that you'll do them a favor by making everything easy for them, you're actually sending a subliminal message, this is not so important. Don't worry about it. Whereas if you challenge the kid and you say, look, this is going to be hard, but it's important, so I need you to do your best, you know? And you work with them, but you raise, you know, you're raising children, literally, you raise them. Then the subliminal message is, don't let this go. This is really important. So coming back to the original point, we have the high holidays. Everybody knows they're important. They're so commonly observed, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. And then there's a steep drop-off. And we have a holiday 4 days later. There's a four days after Yom Kippur. There's four and a half, whatever. 5 days later, there's another holiday, a biblical holiday. And the participation rate is nowhere near where it is in Yom Kippur. Not that it's that easy, but it's kind of easy. Once you get the sukkah up, it's easy.
No, it depends where you live. Cold and rainy.
We're having a warm week next week.
Yeah, we're having nice weather next week. The observance of Sukkot is fairly easy. Once you build the sukkah, all you have to do is be in it. You have to eat there. You have to do your work there. If they have your leisure time there, some people actually sleep in the sukkah.
Have you done that before?
Sleeping? It's not a Chabad custom to sleep in the sukkah, so I haven't, but there are lots of people who do. I know, I have friends who do.
In the sukkah. It's terrible.
Yeah.
I think I qualify as a shofar as mitzvah when I sleep in a sukkah.
Yeah. So, what we want to do is understand the place that Sukkot has in the journey of all these holidays. Because really, the Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur start off our year on this incredible journey with incredible foundations. Rosh Hashanah has the foundational theme of declaring that Hashem is our king, which means we set our compass, and we set our values, we set our direction by that. Who is the boss in your life? Who rules in your life? What power do you bow to? You know, whether it's what power do you conform to? Everybody worships someone, like Dylan sang. And question is, what is that power for you? It could be 5 Instagram influencers. It could be mass media. It could be friends, peer pressure, just general society. It could be an author who you fell in love with. It could be anything. So as Jews and Rosh Hashanah, we declare that that ruler, that authority in our life is Hashem. It's a foundational moment. Yom Kippur, to come in touch with our soul and to ask for forgiveness, to be forgiven, to be cleansed of our mistakes, to be given another chance, to go deeper and find a place where our sin never broke the connection. This is a source of hope for the entire year. It's how we don't give up. It's how we don't fall into despair. And then, there needs to be a bridge. There needs to be something that will allow us to take all that very intense vibes of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and get it connected to the rest of the year, to integrate. Every great experience has to be processed. You know, in Israel, in the army, I forgot what it's called, but they have a rule that after every operation, big and small, whatever it may be, they have a debriefing. And the debriefing is very intense, where everybody has the mic, everybody can talk, and they take the operation apart. What happened? How did things go? What went well? What didn't go well? Why didn't it? What could we do better? Whose idea was that? And everything is analyzed and broken down. And they digest, they process what just happened. They'll just move on to the next thing.
Do other people not do that?
Other militaries?
Yeah.
And there's something unique about it. I was reading an article about this once by... I think what's unique about it in Israeli army is that really that every soldier can speak his mind and you can tell a commander off. Like, it's the one time where you're not going to be disciplined for, like, telling a superior officer off. In these debriefings, it's free range. Total free speech, total equality. No one, there's like no hierarchy. If you have an idea, you're a soldier, you're a simple soldier, and you see something that got overlooked, you speak up. And that's what makes it unique. Like, lots of militaries do debriefings, but it's, you know, top down and hierarchical. And look, I haven't studied this. I just read this in an article, so take it or leave it. But the idea of processing what happened is very important, especially after intense experience. You have to process. You have to debrief. You have to digest. You can't swallow the brisket whole. So it needs to be broken down. So what we're going to learn here today will help us appreciate how Sukkot does that, why Sukkot is filling that void, and therefore why it's so important that we don't just do high holidays, because that leaves us with intense experiences that are dissipated and we don't have a chance to integrate them. And with the Sukkot experience, we're able to integrate and digest over 8-9 days. It's a lot of time. Kippur is 24 hours. 26 hours, 25 hours, whatever. But Sukkot is almost a week and a half. We have time. So, let's begin. The Torah commands, for 7 days you shall dwell in Sukkot. Defining this mitzvah, our sages state, you must live in the Sukkot just as you live in your home. This is the principle known as Teshvu Ke'en Taduru. You should dwell in the Sukkot like you dwell in your house, which means... for the 7 days of the holiday, all the daily routines of our life must be carried out in the sukkah. Again, you eat in the sukkah. It's not just eating meals, snacks. You're sitting on your computer. You're doing work. Do it in the sukkah. You're reading. Do it in the sukkah. You're entertaining guests. You're having company. Do it in the sukkah. Ideally, one of the beautifications of the sukkah would be to make sure that your sukkah has adequate Wi-Fi coverage. Serious. It's a religious imperative to make sure that your sukkah has adequate Wi-Fi coverage. Otherwise, you can't hang out there. There's so many things you need Wi-Fi for. So you need to make sure your sukkah has good Wi-Fi.
But if you normally eat lunch on campus, you don't have to go back to sukkah to eat lunch if you normally eat lunch on campus, right?
There are people who won't take a drink of water outside the sukkah. There are people who will take advantage of the leniency where you can eat snacks and small meals outside the sukkah. So there's a difference between what's mandatory and what's ideal. There's a space between mandatory and ideal.
It's not really just for kids to enter Duru. If you don't eat your lunch at home, you can lunch on campus.
I understand what you're saying. And I'm still saying that there's a space between what's mandatory and what's ideal.
Yeah.
So what you're talking about is what's mandatory. Mandatory has a limit. And then there's ideal. There's ideal. Ideal is beyond the letter of the law. Ideal is getting the spirit of the law. It goes beyond what's mandatory and what's required. And so the idea that you would do whatever you would normally do in your house, in your sukkah, is the idea of the mitzvah of the sukkah. There's no mitzvah in the Torah to eat a meal in the sukkah. The Torah never says, eat a meal in the sukkah. It just says, dwell in the sukkah. And so the sages learn that dwelling means do whatever you would normally do in your house in the sukkah. Whatever that means.
Would people go to the bathroom there?
Oh, great question. Great question. What about going to the bathroom? What about showering? Right?
Yeah.
What about doing the dishes? So, first of all, there's a rule that anything that is sort of undignified should not be done in the sukkah. So we don't even if you have a sink in the sukkah, it's not that hard to get a sink in the sukkah. But you wouldn't be allowed to do your dishes in the sukkah. So that's like anything to do with cleaning up and so on wouldn't belong in the sukkah. The sukkah is considered a bit of a sacred space. I mean, it's not a synagogue, but it's a bit of a sacred space. So there's rules on certain things that don't, certain behaviors that don't belong in the sukkah, even though it would be, you're right, it would be part of what you would do in your house.
But isn't that counterintuitive? Isn't the whole point of the sukkah to do with the undignified things that you normally do in your home? You should tend to that.
Yeah, I think that there's a line that this concept has limits. And one of the limits of the concept are, first of all, just human dignity. It's not really that dignified to shower outdoors, even if you have a shower curtain there and whatever. And also, even though you're going to do all the things that you normally do in your home in the sukkah, being that the sukkah does have some sanctity and some sacredness to it, there are certain things that are just not appropriate in that environment. So, it's a concept that has definition. It's do what you would do at home, but it's also a sukkah. It's a sacred space, so there's limits. As our sages explain, for all these 7 days, one should consider the sukkah as one's permanent dwelling, and one's home as temporary. So it switches around. Person should eat, drink, relax, and study in the sukkah. Our sages point out that the mitzvahs were given for the sole purpose of refining the created beings. Right? There are many different angles given to this point of what does God want from the mitzvahs? Why does Hashem give us all these mitzvahs for? What does He need? What does He need me to do this for? So one of the answers in the Gemara is that the purpose of all the mitzvahs were given for you to become a better person, to refine you. By observing a mitzvah, a person elevates himself and his surrounding environment. You raise the consciousness and you improve your character. Most mitzvahs are focused only on limited aspects of our being and limited dimensions of our environment. Putting on tefillin, one elevates one's head, heart, and arm, as well as the actual leather artifacts involved. When by contrast, a person lives in a sukkah, his entire body is enveloped by the mitzvah. Even the most mundane aspects of his life become means of connection to God. It's a very interesting point. Most mitzvahs, it's not exclusive, but most mitzvahs are specific. They're limited to specific either parts of the body or specific objects. I know you're already thinking about how you can prove me wrong, but most mitzvahs work this way. They're limited to specific areas of either the body or specific items that require the mitzvah be done with them. Huh? Yeah, exactly. Sending the mother bird away when you take the eggs.
How does that live in the body part?
Not a body part. It's limited to the bird. And your hand that shoos it away is, your liver had nothing to do with it.
Well, your hand wouldn't be able to do that if your liver wasn't functioning.
I understand, but it's all indirect. It's all indirect. Like I said, he's already thinking of ways to prove me wrong.
Yeah.
So, when you go in the sukkah, How do you observe the mitzvah of Sukkot? You walk in a sukkah, and you do whatever you would do there. It's essentially eating, but other ways also. And just by walking into the sukkah and being there, you're and eating something, yes, but you're observing the mitzvah with your entire body being there. It's a whole body experience. There's actually a discussion in the Gemara, what happens if somebody's halfway in the sukkah? If his head and his shoulders in the sukkah and his legs are out, does he fulfill the mitzvah? It's a whole debate.
Is it yes or no?
I don't remember offhand. Yeah? I don't remember what the deal is offhand, but I know it's a discussion. Bottom line is, for most of us, we're not going to test the limits of the principle. We'll walk into the sukkah. Head, shoulders, knees, and toes, like the song goes. And this is pretty unique. It's very rare to find a full body mitzvah. So what's the message here? The message of the mitzvah of sukkah is not self-contained. It influences our conduct throughout the entire year to come. The Torah simply tells us to know him in all your ways. As a general rule, we have a concept in Judaism that our relationship with Hashem is not limited to the religious elements of life. One of the unique things about Judaism, very unique, as far as I know, is that all of what you do throughout your day on a daily basis can be fueled and embraced and graced by your relationship with Hashem. Your awareness of Hashem can find expression in everything that you do, not only in overt mitzvahs, but even in your regular routine, your interaction with your friends, interaction with your parents, your work, and so on and so forth. This is the idea we're reading here. Know him in all your ways. Know Hashem in all your ways. B'chol derachecha da'ehu. Which means that your relationship with Hashem and your Judaism is not limited to the synagogue, it's not limited to religious acts. If you're truly in a relationship with Hashem, you're truly aware of Hashem, then how you handle a traffic jam will be different. Serious. How you handle somebody disappointing you, letting you down in some way or another will be different if you're aware of God or not. And that's what it means. Know him in all your ways. Whatever you're doing, know him. And there will be a marked, obvious difference. And our sages comment, this is a short verse upon which all the fundamentals of the Torah depend. What a beautiful line. A short verse upon which all the fundamentals of the Torah depend. In other words, put it this way. Look at what it would be like. I'll give you an example of what it would be like without knowing him in all your ways. Someone is a very great Torah scholar, a genius. He knows the whole Talmud, inside and out. Can quote you chapter and verse from anywhere in the Talmud. But he beats his wife. What's the impression such a person makes? I don't think I have to articulate it. He learned a lot of Torah, but the Torah did nothing to his character. Something's wrong. Somebody missed the plot. There's a missing link here. And conversely, like Rambam writes, that a wise person is noticeable the way he eats. You can tell the difference of someone, two people sitting down to eat. One is a Torah scholar, and one is far from a Torah scholar. There will be a noticeable difference. The way they eat, there's just a difference. Refinement, spiritual elegance, if that makes sense. There's something that the Torah does to a person, and prayer and doing mitzvahs and all the whole religious lifestyle does to a person. Ideally, if they're following this fundamental rule, because godliness is present not merely in the synagogue or in the house of study, but in every dimension and corner of our lives. That's the point. This whole idea rests on the truth that Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is truly everywhere, as the kid's song goes. If Hashem is everywhere, then he's here just as he's in the shul. And he's here in my living room just as he's in the house of study. So then why should I be the one to draw a line separating my awareness of him or my type of conduct between the shul and my living room? Okay, your living room is not a shul. You know, a shul is still a shul. But in terms of your awareness of Hashem and how you conduct yourself throughout the day, that should be in every place and every time. And this concept is made tangible by the mitzvah of dwelling in a sukkah. It's a very nice abstract idea. When you look at a sukkah, and you walk into a sukkah, and you experience a sukkah, you're living this idea. Here we took something that ostensibly is not a shul, it's not a house of study, it's not the Western Wall, it's your backyard. It's your backyard. And now that's a mitzvah. Your backyard became a home base for a mitzvah. And the dinner and the lunch that you're having there is also fulfillment of a mitzvah. Since when is eating lunch a mitzvah? Eating lunch is eating lunch. I have to eat lunch. I have to live. On sukkahs, eating a meal in the sukkah, eat lunch. It's a mitzvah. You're fulfilling the biblical commandment of sukkahs, of sukkot, every time you eat a meal in the sukkah. You don't have that on a random Wednesday. Normally. Or at least you have to work on it on a random Wednesday to feel that somehow this is part and parcel of my relationship with God. Sukkahs makes it easy. Part of why the Talmud says that in the future, after Mashiach comes, the nations of the world will claim, God, it's not fair. If you would have given us some mitzvahs, we would have done it too. We gave the Jews all the mitzvahs, so they earned all the points. And now we have nothing. So God says, oh yeah, you want to do a mitzvah? Okay, I'll give you a mitzvah. It's an easy mitzvah. It's called sukkahs. And Talmud says that all these people who complained about not having opportunities will try to sit in the sukkah, and it will be a hot day. And they won't be able to hack it, and they'll kick the sukkah on the way out, and they'll leave and stomp their way out. But still, the Talmud calls it an easy mitzvah. Why is it easy? Building the sukkah is not so easy. For that, we have Italians. But being in the sukkah, the actual fulfillment of the mitzvah of sukkot, is what? Italians are great builders. Jews are not. How many Jewish builders do you know? There's Jewish...
Father.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. For the sukkah?
No, he has a whole wood shop.
Oh, okay.
He's crazy about it.
He's amazing.
Does he build his own
sukkah?
Yeah. Okay, there are exceptions to every rule. How many friends does he have that are builders like him? They all come to him to borrow tools.
There was a very famous kid once who was a carpenter.
Yeah.
Oh.
Once.
Another exception.
Do you build your own, Rabbi?
I gave up trying a long time ago. My good friend Walter does our sukkah every year. And I threw him a curveball. He came on Tuesday to start building the sukkah after Yom Kippur. I said, Walter, you want to hear a curveball? And he's like, I better sit down. And then he tells me, let me guess. You want to double the size of the sukkah and have running water piped inside. I said, Walter, you're close. I don't want to double it and I don't need the water, but we do need to make it bigger. I figured. And we made it 60% bigger.
So you buy check it out after. Supplies every year, or you rent?
No.
We
keep our supplies. It's wood.
So,
it's custom made. It's wood. It's not prefab. Prefab. You'll take a look outside.
Is that a thing?
What's prefab?
There's prefab sukkahs. Yeah, ready-made sukkah kits that just you assemble.
And is your backyard just open whenever?
Of course. Sukkah is open 24/7 for anybody. Come at 3 a.m. and have a snack.
Really?
Pleasure. Mm-hmm. Of course. Yeah, just come in. There's always tables and chairs. The lights will always be on. Not a problem. So sukkah, the mitzvah of sukkah makes this concept tangible. We could talk about this idea about bringing God into the everyday and being aware of God in the traffic jam. And it's an abstract concept that we have to work on. But then sukkah comes and all of a sudden my lunch became a mitzvah. Hanging out with a friend became a mitzvah. If you put Wi-Fi in your, if you make sure that there's Wi-Fi in your sukkah, and you bring the PlayStation and the screen into the sukkah, which I would argue is a beautification of the mitzvah, because it means you're going to spend more time in the sukkah doing things you would normally do at home. That's a mitzvah too. You can play Call of Duty in the sukkah and you know, Baruch Hashem. Yeah.
When you say that a meal automatically becomes a mitzvah when you eat in the sukkah,
right?
Doesn't a meal become a mitzvah once you like say a bracha for it and like say your karamazon?
So it's not a mitzvah to. There's never a mitzvah to eat food. Eating food is voluntary. You don't want to eat, don't eat.
Okay.
I mean, at some point you have to, right? But making a bracha is just acknowledging that God is master of the world. Before you eat, before you take any benefit or pleasure from the world, you have to acknowledge the master of the world. Fine. It doesn't mean that there's a commandment to eat lunch. right? It's still voluntary to eat lunch. What I'm talking about is that this is part and parcel of the bona fide biblical commandment of celebrating and observing the holiday of Sukkot. Every time you eat lunch in your Sukkot, that's part of the biblical commandment of celebrating and observing Sukkot. So lunch is part of this mitzvah, which is unlike any other time of year. I mean, a Shabbat meal could be a meal that's a mitzvah. And the Seder, you could say, is a meal that's a mitzvah. Other than that, a random Wednesday lunch in a mitzvah.
Shabbat dinner.
Even kosher. Kosher is when you eat, it should be kosher. You know, there's no mitzvah. There's no mitzvah to eat food for the sake of eating food that's kosher.
Oh, but what's the difference between sitting in the sukkah and eating a meal in the sukkah? There's no difference. The meal is not doing anything for the mitzvah.
It's one of the aspects of, I'm just using that as one of the examples. No, one of the aspects of eating, of observing the mitzvah of Sukkot is eating lunch in the sukkah.
But eating lunch in the sukkah, eating lunch is not the mitzvah. It's being in the sukkah that's the mitzvah. So,
right.
You can be eating lunch, you can be playing Call of Duty. 100%. No difference.
100%. There are many different ways to observe the mitzvah. I'm just using eating as one as an example because when you eat normally during the year, that isn't part of any mitzvah. But eating lunch in the sukkah is part of the mitzvah of sukkahs. So that's unique. And this illustrates the concept. It brings it to life. All right? Now, let's try to finish this next paragraph, section. Whenever one fulfills a mitzvah with material objects, a connection is established between them and the spiritual import, spiritual value of the mitzvah. From that time on, they are known as tashmishei mitzvah, objects used for a mitzvah. Since their connection with spirituality remains, an object that has been used in performing a mitzvah should not later be used for unrefined purposes.
You keep the lulav.
You keep the lulav, yeah. We burn it with the chametz and so on. So there's a few different, there's a bit of a hierarchy when it comes to this. So for example, a talis has one level of sanctity, but the strings of the talis have another level of sanctity because they're the actual mitzvah. Well, the garment is only the enabler of the mitzvah. There's no mitzvah to own a four-cornered garment. The mitzvah is, if you own a four-cornered garment, attach the strings. That's it. That's the mitzvah.
Is it okay to use the cutoffs of your dishes to perform kafarim? That's what I can do.
Are you cutting them?
If there's whatever reason. Yeah, I don't think that's a problem. That's a holy thing. You're using it for a sefer.
Wait, can we go back?
They were down to my knees, so I cut them.
They're too long.
He's allowed to cut them?
We'll talk about tzitzit when we get to the tzitzit class. There's an even deeper connection between the building materials used for the sukkah and the spiritual influences associated with it. Okay? The building materials, right? The wood, the screws, the nails, whatever, the bamboo. Thus, our sages say, just as the sacrifices became consecrated for the sake of heaven, so too the sukkah becomes consecrated for the sake of heaven. There's a rule with sacrifices in the Beit HaMikdash. Whenever you would dedicate a cow or a sheep and say, this is going to be eventually brought as a sacrifice in the temple, that animal now has a sacred status. You can't use it for farm work. You can't abuse it. You can't cause it any damage. If you do, you're liable for the value plus penalties. It's a whole song and dance. Because it has sanctity now. It's been dedicated as a sacrifice. So Talmud says that we have the same thing applies. I don't know if it's a Talmud or not. But it says somewhere in the holy books that the sukkah, the materials of the sukkah, the wooden panels that I just bought in Home Depot yesterday they were sitting on a rack in Home Depot, right? They're there to be used for whatever construction needs people might have, right? You know Home Depot owners are Jewish, right?
In what way?
Really?
Home Depot is a massive chain.
Like the company itself?
Yeah, a couple of Jewish boys from Brooklyn. So that's why they have all the supplies for a sukkah there, because they know that the Jews need sukkahs. Yeah,
of course.
So yesterday this plywood is sitting in Home Depot, doing its thing, minding its own business. Me and Walter show up, and all of a sudden, this plywood is now standing as part of the wall of the sukkah, and it's consecrated at the same level of the sanctity of a sacrifice offered in the temple in Jerusalem. It's quite a trip.
Is it actually, are you actually chayav meila if you use the wood for something else?
You're not allowed to use it for anything else. I don't know if you were, we don't have penalties of Me'ila these days without the Beit HaMikdash, but you cannot use, like, you're not allowed to use this. Once it's been used for a sukkah, I can't use that for firewood. I can't use it for, I can't use it for my house.
Can you use it, like, to build a table and then take the table apart and then make it a sukkah again?
I don't think so.
Like a temporary table?
I don't think so. No, it's dedicated for sukkah. It's sukkah or nothing.
What if you use it to make a mezuzah cover? What if you make it to make a railing for a mikvah?
No.
What happens when you're done with it?
You try to find loopholes.
Yeah.
So there's actually rules on disposal.
Okay.
And what you're allowed to, I mean, nothing lasts forever. But there's rules of how you dispose of it and what you do with it, what you don't do with it. Beyond the scope of right now, I just want to finish this, but there is a sort of status of the sukkah materials that become sanctified. The sukkah represents a deeper fusion between materiality and spirituality than that which is achieved through the performance of many other mitzvahs. There's something unique about the sukkah. Sukkah has something that is so integrated. Heaven and earth and spirit and matter become so integrated in a sukkah more than almost any other mitzvah. And this goes back to the point I was making at the beginning. We need to have a system, we need to have a bridge that helps us digest and parse through and sort of, you know, really integrate the experiences of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. They're so high, they're so heavenly, they're so intense. And then you go right back to earth. We need a bridge. This is the bridge. Sukkah is the bridge. In most instances, the connection between the material object and the spiritual effect established through the observance of a mitzvah does not permeate the material entity entirely. Therefore, though we are required to treat them with respect, these objects are not considered holy. They're not totally united with spirituality. Consecration implies that the physical entity becomes suffused with holiness, and this deeper bond is achieved through the mitzvah of dwelling in the sukkah. And so the idea that the sukkah is this sort of embodiment of ultimate integration of spirit and matter is expressed in this law, the restrictions that we have on what else we can use the building material of the sukkah for. And the broader point really is, this is a method or a recipe of how you can integrate the experience of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. In other words, a successful Yom Kippur means that not only you're more religious and more divorced from the world, because that's Yom Kippur mode. Yom Kippur mode is you're in shul all day, you're detached from physicality. You don't eat. You don't bathe. So many things you don't do. So you're angelic. Yom Kippur, you're angelic. The greatness of Yom Kippur is that, you know, you're so angelic, you're so heavenly, you're so out of the norm. It's also, if you could say, I don't want to say this in the wrong way, but it's also sort of the weakness of Yom Kippur. The weakness of Yom Kippur is that it's so disconnected from our regular, normal selves. It's part of the greatness. It's part of why we feel such a high on Yom Kippur. But it's, at the end of the day, I just spent 25 hours doing something I never do all year long. No matter if you're very religious or not religious at all, nobody lives every day like Yom Kippur. So that can't be the way we're meant to do all year long. We need another mode. Sukkot's mode is, if you had a successful Yom Kippur, bring it into Sukkot. If you really had that connection, if you want that connection, you'll find it in the Sukkot. And the Sukkot gives you a sustainable model of living in the presence of God, but being a normal human being, doing your regular thing. They don't have to be light years apart. There should be no daylight between your mundane, regular self and your awareness of God. Don't compartmentalize it. With all due respect, it's a very Christian idea to compartmentalize religion and compartmentalize God outside of your normal day-to-day. First of all, you know, in Christian practice, you go to church once a week, maybe twice a week if you're really religious. If you're a religious Jew, you go to shul every day, three times a day. So there's an integration there already, but it's even there, you can break it down and say, well, it's only integration vis-a-vis your being in shul. Still not the ultimate. Ultimate integration is there's no part of your life that's left untouched by your relationship with Hashem. It becomes a total part of you. Wherever I am, who's having lunch? Me. Well, who is me? Well, I'm a person that has a relationship with God. I'm a person that tries to live in the presence of God. I'm a person that lives with that awareness. Okay, well, then you'll eat lunch differently. And you'll talk to your friends differently. And you'll bite your tongue more often. And so on and so forth. Because you have that awareness. Because you're cultivating that throughout your entire life. That's a bridge. That's something you can live with throughout the year. That's something you can take to the bank. We're running a little over time. So this next section here is a bit of a change in direction about how sukkah leads to unity. So I'm going to skip that just because we're over time already. Let's go to the last paragraph to wrap it up. Our rabbis explain that through dwelling in the sukkah, we will merit the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash, as implied by the verse, and his sukkah will be in Jerusalem. The ultimate fusion between the material and the spiritual will take place in the era of the redemption, and in particular in the Beit HaMikdash, where the divine presence will be openly revealed. May this take place in the immediate future. This is the goal of life. The goal of Judaism is to fuse and integrate material and spiritual, to fuse and integrate soul and body. Never to compartmentalize, never to live in tension. In the ideal Jewish spiritual state, there's no tension between body and soul. Now, that can happen in one of two ways. Either because you become a complete hedonist, and you're like, I don't have any tension, I just love eating, and I love indulging all my cravings. So there's no tension because you just basically, you know, suffocated your soul. The other way of having no tension is when the soul is driving the train. And the body is not going to be suffocated. That's the irony is that when your soul is driving the train, your body has a place. There's room for the body to be the body. But it's under the control of the soul. There's a driver here. We don't have to suffocate the body out of existence. It doesn't work the other way. For a hedonist who has a conscience, if you have a soul, the soul will always bother you. Why are you being such a hedonist? Why are you being such a glutton? So the only way to keep being a glutton is to suffocate the soul. Get out of here. Stop bothering me with your stupid conscience. Right? But get out of my way. You're ruining my vibe.
If you don't have something that tells you glutton is bad, what natural inclination in the human body, in the human spirit, is there that glutton is bad? No,
of course. No, there isn't. Only the soul. That's what I'm saying. So if somebody wants to be there, if their goal is to be a full-fledged 24/7 glutton, then the only way they'll be able to do that is by suffocating the soul and shouting down their conscience all the time.
No, but let's say like society considers glutton one of the seven cardinal sins, whatever, very Christian. But if it didn't, where would the society have the idea not to be?
Nowhere.
Oh,
I don't think. The body on its own doesn't have a... I mean, you get physically ill from eating too much, but you know, not moral. There's no moral conscience to the body. Morality is not a natural component of the physical body. It's spiritual. It's from the soul, from the mind. It's not an anatomical experience. It's not a biological experience.
Why would someone have that now if there's no... If it's not inherent, you need to learn it.
Why would somebody have?
Why would someone have the nag in their soul telling them not to be?
Because they have a soul.
But
you have a soul. You have a soul. You don't have to be educated about your soul. You have a soul.
It's like intuition. It's
yeah.
Like,
everybody has a soul.
I see zero intuition why someone should not eat whatever they want. There's no intuition.
No, there's the experience of human beings that many human beings just have a sense of something. This is morally wrong.
I think that's just something you grew up in.
Maybe.
Or that it's like you learn from your experience. It's like, well, you eat whatever you want and then your tummy hurts. And it's like, that's also your intuition. And yeah. That's also your soul.
Well, the point is that the integration of body and soul is only possible when the soul is in charge. If the body's in charge, the body cannot integrate.
But the soul is going to be in charge just when the soul is present. Like there's
the
no
goal
place.
Is the goal is for the soul to always be present.
But just,
that's the goal.
Okay.
Right? The goal is that the soul should always be present, always be you know, conscious, not subconscious, not in and out. You know, for most of us, the soul kind of comes and goes, and our awareness of the soul comes and goes, and we have good days and bad days, and it's fine, it's very human. But what we're aiming for, really, like he says here, the ultimate will be the time of Mashiach, but we can work our way closer to that, that the soul should be present and, you know, in control all the time. We're working on it.
The soul needs is suffocating for the body. Staying from something is torturous for the body. Like what?
But the soul is intuitive. So the soul isn't going to say, don't eat for 5 days because the body needs to eat. The soul is going to say...
No, but let's say the soul says you should only eat... Your soul tells you should only eat kosher food.
Right.
And the only kosher food that you have available is... the same peanut butter and jelly sandwich right. every single day.
No, so the body can sometimes definitely, you know, resist what the soul wants. There's tension. That's the default state. Default state is until you rehab the body, until you train the body, which takes years of work. This is not you take one class and like, oh, I get it now, everything's gonna be fine. It's years and years of inner work to move the needle on this, even. Never mind to arrive. I don't know if you ever arrive, but to move the needle, it's years of work. And at the outset, the beginning of a person's work, when they try to work on this stuff, the body is saying, absolutely not.
How can you make someone eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches every single day, 3 times a day? Like, it'll get torturous.
It's not sustainable, probably. Yeah, you need to have some options. It's probably not sustainable.
So that's what I'm saying.
So it's difficult.
Why would there be something that's unsustainable if it's what your soul really needs?
Because your body's not on the soul's wavelength yet. A perfect tzaddik who has no tension at all, no struggle at all, probably could eat peanut butter sandwiches every day. Because he sees food just as a means to an end. He has no desire for the pleasure of food itself like most of us do. We get bored if the same menu is offered, you know, 3 days in a row. But, you know, again, that's a very advanced state of spiritual enlightenment to not be attached to the particulars of the menu. I'm not there yet. But also it's there's a spectrum. Some people are, I must have this or else. And some people are like, yeah, I mean, I like chicken, but I can have tuna. You know, you become more flexible. You become more open to doing whatever it takes to keep a kosher diet. If it means that I'll have to have tuna sandwiches 3 days in a row. Whatever. I'm not happy. I'm not dancing, but I can do it. You know? And then there's the person who doesn't even care, which is very rare and very lofty level. I wouldn't say that's relevant to most people. But the tension is there. The tension is there at the outset of the journey. There is tension between the body and the soul at the beginning, and hopefully, over time, as we work on it, the tension becomes more controlled and lessened and weakened. And Sukkot is really a great example of what it would be like to live in an environment with no tension, because here you are eating, and it's a mitzvah. So you don't have to break yourself to do the mitzvah. You're good to go. So Chag Sameach. We'll see you in the Sukkah. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to devote your attention to learning about Judaism, picking up some knowledge about Torah, and most of all, stimulating the next steps in your own spiritual journey. I'd love to hear from you with any comments, feedback, questions, challenges, rebuttals, you name it, to what you've heard in this episode. Please reach out to me anytime by email at rmg@jewishwaterloo.com. Have a great day. Bye.